brought in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose 14th annual Professor's Lecture presents The Debate Between Einstein and Bohr and Its Consequences for Quantum Computing by Carl Hess on Wednesday, November 3rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium, Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. Quick mention of tomorrow. In the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Max Frankel. He has been a journalist with the New York Times for 50 years. He's winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He has a new book out that looks back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's titled High Noon in the Cold War, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll talk about that in the first part of the show. Hour two, tomorrow, we'll be talking about water and the fact that more and more, various places around the world, people are fighting about it, control of it, access to it. And our guest for the program will be Amita Bhaviskar. She is a sociologist at the University of Delhi in India who will be visiting here the campus to give a talk. This is in the Millercom series. That's tomorrow night. She'll be with us tomorrow morning, and we'll cover some of the same material. And, of course, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always, of course, welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about food. Now, this is something that we talk about on the program, on and off, and certainly once a month. For a long time, we've been doing this show, and we did it the first hour this morning where we talk about cooking and exchange recipes and always have a good time. This hour, when we talk about food, it will be in, I think, a slightly different way, and that is what we can learn about people and culture and perhaps history by looking at the subject of food. Who cooks, what they cook, how they cook. That's something that's been an interest of our guest, Barbara Haber, for quite a long time. She's the author of a book that's titled From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals. This is a book that first came out in the spring of 2002, and then in paper, published by Penguin just last year, June of 2003, which takes a look at cooking and food in American history at various periods. She's also written about food for many different publications, Los Angeles Times, Harvard Magazine. She's co-authored the chapter on culinary history in the Cambridge World History of Food. Until relatively recently, she also served as curator of books at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. And when she was there, she worked to develop one of the country's most important collections of cookbooks and books on food history, over 16,000 volumes, in fact. Also there, they have papers of food figures, including MFK Fisher, Angelia Child, and Elizabeth David. So her interest in food and cooking goes back some ways. She's here visiting the campus. She's here at a visit sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program, and in fact gave a talk last night on the campus, and was good enough to come here and spend time with us this morning. So after all that, if you have questions you'd like to get in on the conversation, that's welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good. Anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Glad to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Maybe just to begin, I'm interested in starting at the end of Hardtack to Home Fries, this chapter about what cookbooks mean.
Right.
And, you know, I think about the fact that if you go into a bookstore, the cookbook section is enormous. And in addition, if you go to where the magazines are, a lot of magazines on cooking. There are many websites devoted to cooking today. And, of course, on cable television, we have an entire channel
that's
24 hours a day. And I'm sure that there would have been a time when the Food Network was getting going and the idea, someone put out the idea, I'm sure people would have said, you're kidding, right? 24 hours a day cooking shows. And of course, it's been very, very popular. And some of the people on the Food Network have become big stars because of their of the programs that they have done. All of that would suggest that we're obsessed with with food and with cooking. What do you make of that?
It's phenomenal, is what I make of it. Compared to the earlier years when cooking shows were on radio and not very often, it was a modest thing. And I think that on television, a lot of the credit went to Julia Child, who was unusual that she was given prime time on public television. Mm-hmm. And I think she started a trend. But I think that what the Food Network has accomplished is really quite extraordinary. I've been on airplanes where everyone has a private television set, and very clear from the way some of the male passengers were dressed, you'd expect them to be watching the business networks, but they were watching the Food Network. And all I can say is that food has become a spectator sport. It's mm-hmm. entertainment. I think people sublimate real eating by instead hearing about it or reading about it. I've come across a statistic that 20% of books published are cookbooks. Nobody really knows how many there are because we can't keep track of the privately published books that are often put out to support local churches or arts groups or whatever. Mm. People love it. And let me tell you, people collect these things. I know that because when I was curator at the Schlesinger Library, frequently I would get calls from people offering to donate their books to the library.
Yeah.
And especially they would call me offering to donate their 20 years of Gourmet magazine. And it was heartbreaking to have to tell them that I didn't need their set because we already
had plenty of them. Yeah. Someone, and not, I don't recall who this was, though, it coined this term for this fascination with cooking and food. And I think the term was gastroporn.
Gastroporn, right. That's in the vernacular now.
And which speaks to the degree of the obsession, I guess. What sort of need does it touch in people?
It varies. You will have noticed that the cookbooks that have been published in the last 15 or 20 years are lavish. They cost about at least $35 or $40. They're not simple books of recipes. One expects beautiful, you know, multicolored photographs of the food, and you're disappointed if the photographs aren't there. So the books are very expensive. I think it's possible for people who I know they do. They buy these books and they're not in their kitchens. They're in their bedside tables. They're reading about food. They're reading about food in foreign countries in lieu of travel. And my best example of a kind of gastroporn, which to me means, you know, instead of doing it, you're reading about it, is a collection that came from an elderly woman whose brother had died, and to her complete astonishment, his bedroom closet was filled with hundreds of cookbooks, and she didn't even know of his interest, and did the library want them? I was thrilled to get the collection for the library because these books had never seen a kitchen. They had not
once, spotless.
No butter stains or cake batter anywhere. And so I took them, and I had to go through them to see, you know, what we would keep for the collection and all of that, and in many cases substitute his copy for what it was on the shelf. But what I also found were pages of writing, of listing of recipes, peanut butter cookies or chocolate-covered peanuts, and written in a spidery hand. And there were other clues that would suggest that this was a man on a really limited, restricted diet who could only pretend or think about eating, you know, the delectable, delicious, comforting things that he remembered from earlier times.
Mm-hmm. So also what's interesting to me is, well, and on the one hand, we have a lot of people who are fascinated with food and cooking and love to, if not cook, look at the books and watch people on television who are professionals and have elevated those people to be celebrities. I suppose they always sort of were in a way, but even more than it used to be. And at the same time, we are told that Americans have a weight problem, mm-hmm. and that we can trace that to a couple of things. One might be lack of physical activity, but the other is poor choices and people eating a lot of prepared foods that are not very healthy, that have a lot of the big tastes that maybe human beings are prone to like anyway, sugar, salt, and fat.
Yeah.
And it seems that in a sense, when it comes to food, we have these two Americas of people who maybe aren't thinking very much about what they eat, or maybe aren't eating very carefully, and maybe aren't eating very well. And then this other group, which I would assume to be the smaller group, that are interested in cooking, at least theoretically, at a very sophisticated level. What does that tell us?
Well, I would even go so far as to say is the war is within a single person. That, first of all, you have the enormous availability of rich and fattening and unhealthy foods. At the same time, you have campaigns going on that try to educate people about making choices. So, in fact, right before coming to Illinois, I read quickly about a new discovery made by a Harvard scientist that there are two separate parts of the brains that operate that cause the contention within individuals. On the one hand, it's part of the brain that leads to addiction. So that could account for going after the sugar and fat and salt and what have you. And the other part is the reasonable part of the brain that says, you're not supposed to have that. You're supposed to eat yogurt and fruit. And I think that we are constantly dealing with the battle as individuals. And why then is it not a surprise that the whole society is dealing with this as a battle?
Well, one of the chapters in the book is devoted to a discussion of two famous names in health food. People who were food reformers that we probably know now because their names have been attached to particular foods.
Products.
That is Mr. Graham, who was the father of the Graham cracker, and Mr. Kellogg, who I'm not sure it was as much him as it was his brother, popularized cornflakes.
Right.
And both of them had very strict ideas about health, that people should avoid all of the fun stuff, should avoid caffeine and alcohol. I think probably they were both believed that everybody should be vegetarians.
Absolutely.
And that they had, you know, very applied these very strict sort of regimens about how people should live, and had this idea that there was this very strong connection between your health and what you ate. So I guess that really the idea that that there is this connection, and that there are people who want to whip you into shape by saying, you know, eat this way and don't eat these things.
Right.
Has that always been with us?
Well, I end that chapter by talking about dieting these days. So I obviously see this all as a continuum, and it was very interesting. In the mid 19th century, people were drinking whiskey for breakfast. I mean, water wasn't safe. They were drinking cider, and they were drinking all kinds of hard things that beer that we wouldn't think is a very good idea these days. Meat, particularly pork and fatty cuts of pork, were served maybe three times a day, and lots of salt. Vegetables were hard to come by unless you had a garden, and if you lived in New England, that would be only a few months of the year that would be available. So there's no question that people were eating badly, they were drinking badly, and Americans needed reforming. Americans needed reforming for all kinds of other reasons, but it was Sylvester Graham's genius to attach reform to what we were eating, and his belief in abstinence of all sorts was his credo. And he had a huge influence on a whole line of people that followed, including Dr. Kellogg, who opened the famous sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan.
Yeah. Is this something where you think something that you think is particularly American?
The reforming impulse, absolutely.
Yes.
I think that we think if we change ourselves, then somehow we will have an impact on what happens to everybody else. I see this in women's history so much. A lot of the 19th century household management books talked about advising women that if they learned to cook well, if they learned to housekeep well, that then they would keep husbands out of saloons and taverns. And it put the so pressure on keeping the American family safe and sound on the individual duty of the woman in this case. Mm-hmm. So that's one particular example. But I think in general that we are always interested in motivational speakers. We're interested in new diets, new techniques, new advice. it's not difficult to get going on something like that and get a following. I think that Americans are self-critical enough so that they will succumb to a lot of this kind of leadership.
Yeah, we don't seem to be able to stick with it.
No, I think somebody else comes along, and then maybe it's a short attention span as well. Mm-hmm. What's phenomenal today, I think, is the endurability of the Atkins diet. I learned recently that some pasta factories in Italy are closing because of the falling off of purchase of their product.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting because I think not very long ago I recall reading something about, and I'm sorry that I can't, I wanted to make note of it and I didn't, but it was somebody who tracks food trends, mm-hmm. who said that he thought that maybe the interest in this no-carb or low-carb kind of way of eating had peaked, and that in fact we have a lot of people who they miss their bread, they miss their pasta, and that maybe people will be going back to eating those other things because they didn't, you know, they could give them up for a while, but didn't want to give them up forever.
Well, the other thing is that there have been no long-term studies of people who stay on a low carbohydrate diet. What we do know is that people who all diet in different ways start off, and the people who skip the carbs lose faster. But after a year, the low-calorie people will catch up, and everybody's sort of at the same place. What we don't know is what happens after 2 or 3 years by someone going on essentially a high-fat and high-protein diet. Mm-hmm. And I think when those studies come out, it probably will have an impact. Mm-hmm.
Our guest this morning is Barbara Haber. She's authored a book that explores some of these ideas. The book is titled From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals, and it's now available in a paperback edition published by Penguin. She's the former curator of books at Harvard University's Schlesinger Library, which, interestingly enough, as I understand it, is intended to be a library specializing in women's history.
That's right.
And you have Betty Friedan's papers there.
Absolutely.
For example.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess that it was somewhat the idea of of collecting all these cookbooks. Some people said, well, now wait a minute. That's not the kind of image of women that we're really interested in here.
There's a lot of explanations for that. Cooking and cookbooks have received a bum rap, along with kitchens, from the point of view of early feminists whose job it was, they felt, to give attention to women in the public sphere, so that a lot of the earlier generations of people doing women's history, earlier 70s I'm thinking of, were interested in talking about suffrage and abolition and temperance and the big social movements, or women who had made significant changes in the American labor history movement, or other sort of heroines who had an impact on social progress, Jane Addams, people like that. I felt that there have always been more heroines. More women have been at home taking care of families than have been doing these other kinds of things. And my feeling always has been that these people, this too is women's history. And one way of talking about cookbooks is saying that this is their literature, that cookbooks describe American life or any kind of national life and give you all kinds of clues to the people who cooked and who served and who took care of other members of their families.
Yeah. Well, I know one of the things that you've said that you think is that when it comes to historical resources, that cookbooks are underutilized.
Right.
That in fact, they have a lot of things that they can tell you.
Right.
But that historians haven't often tapped into them.
I purposely chose subjects in my book to talk about the Civil War, for example, or World War II, the Philippine Theater, the Irish famine, big subjects, big historic important things, in order to tell a food story within the framework of mainstream history, and to show that women who were responsible for food and the feeding of people made a difference within the context of war.
Mm-hmm. Well, give an example.
A lot of the women who served as volunteer nurses in the Civil War were responsible for what was called diet kitchens. These were constructed by Army surgeons who knew nothing about nutrition. Most people didn't know anything about nutrition at the time, the 1860s. So they made up crazy to modernize formulas and diets to be given to wounded soldiers. If the guy had a bad cough, then give him donuts. There was whiskey and a lot of hard liquor involved in all the diets, but they seemed really not sensible in terms of what we know today of nutritional science. But the women were instructed to follow these doctors' orders because the doctors had the power in these hospitals. However, when the women were dealing with the patients, sick and dying men, who had a craving for milk or for eggs or for whatever, they knew that if they got the foods that they were craving for, it would do them more good than to follow some abstract order. And so they broke rank. They did their best to procure, to look and find the foods that would comfort these soldiers, and a lot of them did much better. These were women who were used to dealing with sick people, with children, with aged parents and all the rest of it. They were transferring those skills to the war front, and I took great note of that.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that I'm really struck by, and it's an particularly profound sort of understanding to come to, but that when it comes to food, whatever you grew up with, whatever your mother made or your grandmother, because indeed, of course, it's going to be the women who were the home cooks, that's what you think is food. And it can be no small thing to get people to have something different, to try something different, because that's just not – when you see it on the plate – it's like the to go back to the story about the women in the Civil War. It's about the Jewish Confederate woman who was searching for what it is she could serve the troops that would help them. And she said, well, chicken soup, that would probably be good. And so she serves. There's this wonderful quote where she serves a bowl of chicken soup to a soldier, and she decided to put parsley in it. And he said, well, it's not like my mammy made, and, you know, maybe I could get some of it down, except for these weeds that you have floating around in there. So it's sort of, like the Garrison Keillor joke about home cooking if you happen to have been raised that way.
That's right. That's right. Well, human beings, unlike pets or other animals, give enormous meaning to what we eat. We connect it with particular occasions, birthday celebrations, Christmas, Thanksgiving especially is such an American holiday, and it's full of traditions. I know I myself produce and replicate my mother's Thanksgiving meal. And my own rule, just for myself, is I can always add something, but I can't take anything away. So I'll always prepare the exact meal my mother prepared. And if I want to throw in an extra pie, fine, but don't take away the pies that she always served. Mm-hmm. Because it's more meaningful. I'm in communion with my mother, I think, every Thanksgiving. She's been gone a long time, but it brings back a lot of positive feelings for me. And I think that's what happens with people all the time. A certain kind of birthday cake will be de rigueur for a birthday. Picnics, 4th of July celebrations, they're all just loaded for us.
Yeah. Historically, if you take a look at who has done forever most of the cooking, it's women.
It is women. Yeah.
Women are the cooks. People who cook professionally, that is people, who cook for a living, who are paid to be cooks, the chefs, mm-hmm. have been men. Now,
right.
in recent years, I think we're starting to see more and more women go into cooking as a profession and becoming well-known and recognized.
Right.
And indeed, if you look through the pages of the cooking magazines and you see the things that they have written about who are the important cooks, what mm-hmm. are the food trends, what are the restaurants that are getting a lot of attention,
right.
more and more and more, you're seeing women as the executive chefs,
right.
And as people who are determining the menus and making the food and so forth. What do the numbers look like in terms of pros? I wonder if you know how it breaks down according to gender.
I don't know the exact numbers, but I know it's still a male-dominated profession. And I would also point out, this is hard work. I mean, until recently in this country, and certainly it's true abroad, it's blue-collar work. People work long hours. They get to work at about, let's say a restaurant is open just for dinner, and you're responsible for the kitchen. You get there 11, 12 o'clock in the early afternoon, make sure that the line chefs are there, that the prep is going on and all the rest of it. You don't get home till about 11, 12 at night. That's the life of a professional chef. Also, men and women can't keep on doing it. It's a young people's profession.
Yeah. It's very hard work. You spend all your time on your feet.
Right.
Restaurant kitchens are very hot.
Exactly.
You get cut. You get burned.
And you're carrying, lugging heavy things. And a
yeah.
lot of women, it's true, can do it. And if they're successful, Boston has quite a few female owners and chefs. Lydia Shire, for instance, Jody Adams is there. They've all been awarded and received a lot of attention. But I'm anxious to see how they move. Lydia Shire is more doing management now. She's hired executive chefs in her restaurants. And because Lydia is no longer a kid. Hmm. So, you know, like any work, the higher up you go, the more management you're doing and the less hands-on.
Yeah. It interests me, I guess, in a way that is the reality of working in a kitchen. That is the number of people who are really at the top, who make decisions, who make a lot of money, are very few.
That's right.
And that most everybody else, they don't make a great deal of money, and it's very hard work. And so that's the reality, and yet there seem to be this growing number of people that are fascinated with the idea of that as a career. And some of those people are people who have had some other career doing something else,
right,
and are wanting to do this as a second career.
That's right. That's right. Particularly if they're in the law, a lot of lawyers are being retooled and going to cooking school. And I was just I met a young chef the other day. I was in his restaurant. Quite a young guy, early 30s still, and I was hearing about his day and what his plans are and all the rest of it. And he, too, said that he expects that he won't be able to do this. And when he's even 40, that sounds like a kid to me. But it seems to him that he would burn out by then and that his plans would be to expand and hire, maybe get a second or a third restaurant and be managing all three, but putting executive chefs in each of those places.
Hmm.
There's glamour. The other thing he said that I wanted to talk about was how he felt when he first saw his restaurant kitchen as a kid, and he looked at the commotion, the hysteria, the excitement, the drama back, and it's like theater. In the front, people are sitting, demurely being taken care of by waitstaff, and in the back, there's all this wild drama going on, and he thought, this is for me. People fall in love with that scene.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk with some people who are listening. Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I've been trying to avoid hydrogenation ingredients, and this is really hard, especially when I go grocery shopping and I'm cooking for my family. The ages of my children are 14 on down to 4, and of course my kids want foods that have lots of partially hydrogenated oils. Do you see this as something that's going to get better as far as ingredients and stores not having so much of these trans fats? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I know that, I don't know if it's passed yet, but I think so, that pretty soon the food labeling will indicate if products have hydrogenated fats in them. My own point of view is not to buy them. When I shop in a grocery store, I go all around the edges, and I don't go much through the middle aisles. And I think it's all the cookies and the crackers and that kind of stuff that's full of that stuff. It's not hard to make cookies. It's not even hard to make crackers. I know this sounds hard. But if you just sort of try to make some of these products that could be both appealing to your children and also healthy for them, I think you would get so much satisfaction out of doing that. And just steer them away from the foods that are too salty or too fatty with the wrong kinds of fats. And I have found that if kids early on taste good and healthy food, they'll have a preference for it.
Mm. And do you think that if we get to the point where the trans fats are actually labeled and it's on stuff, that people are going to pay attention to that and it's going to influence their decisions about what they buy?
Well, it worked with cholesterol. Which was it started that whole anti-fat craze when people were buying all those sugary cookies and they got sick, with diabetes. There's a lot of educating that still has to go on. And I think if people are made aware, and some health professionals feel that the trans fatty acids are the worst things that you can possibly eat, I think knowing that, you're not going to give it to your kids, and so you have to find some substitutes. I think people will, yes.
We're a little past the midpoint here, and we're talking with Barbara Haber. She is a former curator at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, where she developed one of the country's most important collections of cookbooks and also books on food history, over 16,000 volumes. Also, there they have the papers of food notables, including M.F.K. Fisher and Julia Child and Elizabeth David. She has written for various publications about food, and she is the author of the book From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals. This this is now available in a paperback edition. It's published by Penguin. So if you're interested, you can go out there in the bookstore and look for it. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about some of the things that are in the books. And I guess one of the things that I find pretty interesting is the story about the food in the Roosevelt White House. Apparently because there, for a long, long time, the sort of the story was that it was just awful.
It was awful.
And the question was, well, why was it so awful? And apparently it was because the cook was just not a very inspired cook.
That's right. That's right. If you look at any book of memoirs written during the by any of Roosevelt's contemporaries, everyone talks about how bad the food was in the White House. And the saying around Washington was, if you're invited there for dinner, eat first, because the food was bound to be bad. And as far as I was concerned, and it was sort of the last chapter that I wrote for this book, and I address it as an unresolved historic mystery. And so I looked into it, and what was wonderful is that I found out that the woman responsible for the White House food had left behind a memoir and a cookbook. And I felt I could really do justice to this story and get at the truth by reading all the negative stuffs and then reading her own defense of her position. And in reading it, I discovered that there had been a very special relationship between this woman, her name was Henrietta Nesbitt, and Eleanor Roosevelt. They had been friends in Hyde Park. Mrs. Nesbitt's husband had lost his job, and she rolled up her sleeves and started baking. She knew how to bake and baked well and sold it to neighbors. The Roosevelts bought her products, and then when they went on to be governors, he was the governor, they would order products from Hyde Park and sent on the train to be sold, you know, to be served in the governor's mansion. And so the next step was for Mrs. Nesbitt and her husband to be invited to work at the White House, where she was the head housekeeper and he was in charge of the inventories. And the complaints went on. The Roosevelt children were in and out of that house all the time. The food was like boarding house food. She would serve cheap cuts of meat like tongue and innards of sorts and have a revolving pattern of five or six different menus over and over again. Nothing fancy at all. And it's easy to condemn her if you just look at that side of it. But then I read her side of it, and she points out that they were in the midst of a depression and then a war. Things were scarce. It wasn't proper, she felt, for the people in the White House to be eating and serving food that was sort of high off the hog when everybody else was told to tighten their belts. She was concerned about Roosevelt's infirmities that and he had bad eating habits. He ate too much butter and cream and all that sort of thing. And she was her conviction that men had to be encouraged to eat their vegetables. So she had a kind of infantile attitude about, you know, what men were like. And for all these reasons and budgetary reasons, there was no special amount of money in addition to what Roosevelt was paid. The money that went on the table for food on the table came from his own pocket. And so for all those reasons, she served the kinds of simple fare that and she was very fond of gelatin salads, which men particularly hated. They were in vogue at that time, and she learned how to make them when she visited a Stauffer restaurant and so on. So at the bottom of the mystery, what I see from everything she says about Eleanor Roosevelt and from what Eleanor Roosevelt says about Henrietta Nesbitt, they were good friends. And my conclusion is that this woman stayed in the White House for 12 years because Eleanor Roosevelt, one, did not care much about food anyway, and two, because she trusted her. She knew, even though the food wasn't delectable, it would be served on time and everybody would be fed appropriately. And in the meantime, Eleanor had other things to do than worry about running the house.
We have some other folks to talk with. Someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The caller... I'm sorry, the answer previously about, for some reason, lawyers getting into cooking prompts me to ask whether you know any interesting stories or anecdotes about the history of legal involvement in foods. It's prompted because I know of one in which the Supreme Court was finally involved in deciding whether, for commercial reasons, tomatoes would be a fruit or a vegetable. And since you've had so much experience dealing with food, I was hoping you'd have some more of these non-trivial and oddball anecdotes. I'll hang up and listen.
I wish I did. I don't do legal history, and nothing surfaces. What popped into my mind when you spoke, though, was the business of who was the president that tomato ketchup should be considered a vegetable.
I think that was Mr. Reagan.
Was that Reagan? Yeah. In connection with what would be an appropriate school lunch program, and that really got a lot of press. And I think people who do agricultural history would really have a lot to say about all of that. I suppose the more I talk, the more things occur to me. But there have been laws about adulterating bread, especially all over the world. That bread that has been such a staple before the Atkins diet in Western countries had to have a certain amount of nutritional value, and that some bakers, particularly in the 19th century, were adulterating it. They were extending the flour with other white substances that were not food. And so the law stepped in to create laws that insisted that food had to be this, that, or the other. And the pasteurization laws occur to me when we don't sell raw milk in stores. It has to be pasteurized. You know, and anything that has to do with public safety. And I think if we all had more time to think about it, we could come up with the long list.
All right. To someone in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, the library that you were associated with, whether or not you had, let's put it this way, the oldest cookbook sort of designation. And, you know, how far back do you go? Do you have things from the medieval period and things like that?
This particular library did not have things that went as far back as Apicius, which is a book that's considered the oldest cookbook in the world. It's Roman era. And the only one that I know of in the United States is in New York at a medical library, New York Medical Library. The Schlesinger Library was especially strong in American cookbooks, and obviously America didn't go back all that long. It also had a very strong collection of French cookbooks. I would say it had some 17th century material, but its strength in the rare area was mostly 18th and 19th century.
Hmm. But the oldest cookbook we have is Roman.
How, right.
About when?
Oh, I can't remember the date, so I'm not going to say it, but it's considered the first cookbook. The date just went out of my head. Earlier, there are some tablets. There are some, I think Yale has some kind of engraved tablets that have beer recipes. I've heard that that exists.
Okay. Other questions? Welcome. We have about 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with culinary historian Barbara Haber. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the chapters in the book is about the Harvey girls and about the, mm-hmm. these restaurants that were started to go along with a train line, because at the time, people there wasn't much in the way of good food if you were traveling by train, and that this man, Mr. Harvey, had this idea that you could establish a chain of restaurants and that people would definitely respond if you could give them good service, reliably good food in a very clean place, and that people would definitely flock to them because the other choices were bad to none.
That's right. He was a genius, I think. He was an Englishman who came to this country when he was about 15, had knocked around New York and the South and learned, he knew what good food was. And he connected with the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. And together they produced the idea that if the restaurant was at every depot, that locals would come and use it, but also that people who traveled east to west would be able to have a variety of meals that would be served quickly and well. What he was combating was that the two options that people had was either that they would carry their own food for, let's say, a 3 or 4 day trip, and it would be fly ridden by the time they got to day 3 or even 2, particularly if it was warm, there was no refrigeration. The other option was that there were these scam artists along the way who were operating restaurants, and people would disembark from the train, go in, they would be asked to pay up front, and then the food would be served really very, very hot. And before people had a chance to eat it, the proprietor of the restaurant would be in cahoots with the conductor on the train, who would toot the horn of the train, telling everybody to get back right on. And they didn't have a chance to finish it. And the same stuff would be reheated for the next set of victims. So Harvey came along and offered superb food and beautiful service and the whole sort of glamour of young women from the East were hired by him to be the servers. They were called Harvey Girls. And they were, you know, dressed appropriately and served beautifully. And my contention in that chapter is that I think the West wound up with about 100,000 of Harvey girls who wound up marrying ranchers and railroad men and what have you. And that, in a sense, they founded the West.
Hmm. Are there other important ways in which the restaurant and particularly a thing that now I guess we would call a chain restaurant, it had an important effect on how it is people thought about food or thought about eating?
Well, I think the automobile probably is a way to look at it. Once we had that kind of rapid transportation and individual transportation, you got hotels and motels, and I'm thinking of Howard Johnson now, for instance, where you could be served again. You'd know what you would get. The consistency is a big thing, especially today in all fast food agencies. And people could stop and get a reliable meal at a reliable price and be on their way again. I think what sets apart modern fast food chains from what Harvey was doing is that Harvey was subsidized. So he could serve food that was really extremely good. And we don't get the quality today in fast food restaurants that he was doing.
Well, it was very striking what you write about in the chapter, that his restaurants lost money.
They did. They were expected to lose money. If he saw that people were making a profit, he would immediately zoom down and question the manager. And he would find out, for instance, that instead of cutting the pie into four parts, he was cutting it into six parts, and he put a stop to it. Or the ham was being cut too thin. He was stinting on ingredients.
Yeah, so you tell the story about someone specifically who the restaurant was doing something. It was like losing $1,000 a month, and he found a way to cut it down so it was only losing $500 a month. And Mr. Harvey came and fired the guy.
That's right.
And put somebody else in there so he would go back to losing $1,000 a month.
That's right, because it was a loss leader. People would take their trips along the Atchison, Topeka in order to get that kind of food. And so the whole equation was based on the fact that the food had to be a reasonable price and the quality had to be enormously high.
So it was actually good for the railroad. People chose that railroad because of
Harvey, right, and it was a small price to pay for the price of the tickets and the following that they got.
Yeah. Just fairly recently, one of my colleagues on the afternoon program that we do here talked with one of the editors of Gourmet Magazine's new cookbook, which is this enormous, enormous book full of recipes, and it's a general cookbook. And I heard the conversation, and what I thought was interesting was that the man that Celeste was talking with was making some comments about how over time we have changed the way we eat.
Right.
And you could certainly see that by looking at recipes, particularly when you look at the older recipes because they have a lot of salt, cream, and butter.
Right.
And he said, you know, some of the older recipes, just they have – people wouldn't tolerate that much butter in the recipe anymore.
You would pass over such a recipe, or lard in apple pie dough. Yeah.
And although there are still people who would swear that's the only way you can make a good pie crust is to put lard in there. But I guess I'm thinking of, you know, ways in which we have really changed the way that we eat and we think about cooking, and that just being one of them. That is, particularly we've cut way back on butter. If you go back to look at Craig Claiborne's book, which at one time was a sort of a standard book, the New York Times cookbook, and probably was on a lot of people's shelves. Mm-hmm. You look at some of those recipes and you just say, no, we just wouldn't do that now.
Well, they'll be very fussy. There'll be too many ingredients. They'll be hard to do. They won't include the ingredients that we now have that are available. I was asked recently, does the world really need a new comprehensive cookbook like the Gourmet book? Mm-hmm. And the competing volume has been put out by Cooks Illustrated, which is the best of. And I say, yeah, the more the better. Because I like to look at these books as statements about what food is like at this particular time and place. And it's very revealing to compare the new Gourmet with the one that came out in the 50s, for instance, which has bear meat in it or wild ducklings, because it too was taken from the pages of Gourmet, which had a lot of game cookery in those days. And so they do tell a story that only these comprehensive volumes can answer.
Are today's recipes, are the ingredient lists, do they tend to be shorter than they have been in the past?
I think so. I don't know if you know the Silver Palette cookbook. It was a real sensation when it came out. There are very good recipes, and each recipe is about on one page. It doesn't go on for pages. And they do have a simple list of ingredients. And it made very good food available to people, stylish food available to people, and doable for a lot of people. And I think that we use more olive oil now. I now read that they're probably going to put a statement on olive oil bottles saying it's probably very good for your heart, and that will increase olive oil sales even more than they are now. I think that's true.
And I think the other thing that struck me in having listened to that conversation was and obviously the guy's he's pitching his book, which I'm sure he thinks is a good book, but that one of the things that he talked about was that a lot of the recipes, I'm a little dubious of a claim like that, but he said basically a lot of the recipes you could do, say, in about 30 minutes, certainly an under an hour. Now, I still think that means if you're a fairly experienced cook and you've made it more than once, so that you kind of got it down. Theoretically, yes, you could get to the point where probably if you were fairly comfortable in the kitchen and you were organized.
Right.
You could actually do it in 34 minutes.
And had done your shopping and knew where you stored things and all the rest of it. Yeah, there's a lot of qualifications that come into it. Yeah. But I think it's true. If you've done all those things and done the preparation that you can started heating up the pan before you took your coat off. There are the shortcuts.
I'm just curious. What do you think is the basic difference between a professional cook and the home cook, and even a pretty good home cook? I mean, really, what makes the difference?
All right. I happen to be someone who doesn't cook from chef's cookbooks, and for a reason. Every recipe will refer you back to two other recipes. They'll tell you to use some of your homemade broth, and then you go to the page with the homemade broth, and that's something that has to cook for 12 hours. Every good restaurant kitchen will have this kind of, homemade broth. That's the basis of a lot of sauces. But the home cook doesn't have that. We'll have a bouillon cube or a paste. If you pay a little more, you'll get a good sort of chicken-based paste that you can make a broth with. And it's just more steps and more complications, because chef's cooking has to be innovative in order for him to be famous and to be the celebrity he is. And the cookbooks now these days, celebrity chefs who have television programs and the books are the tie-in, this is the basis of a lot of cookbook publishing. And the poor little home gifted cook who doesn't have a famous name is going to have problem being published unless she becomes a TV star.
Yeah. Something that I'd like maybe as a way of, we have a couple minutes left, as a way of finishing up, and just to tie with the fact that the Family Resiliency Program brought you here. One of the things that is lamented is the loss of the family dinner.
Right.
The fact that people are feeling very rushed. People are going off in 50 different directions. They're all very busy. And that we see less and less family sitting down and eating together. And a lot of people regard that as a loss.
I do. I absolutely do. I mean, when my kids were young, and my family I instituted very few rituals in the way our house was run. But one of the strongest observance we had was that we had dinner together. And so people didn't have appointments around the dinner hour. Now, I'm a good basic cook and I'm a quick one, so that putting a meal on the table was not a big deal. And I also recognize the instant gratification you get as a cook to produce something that for your family that people really enjoy. So when I told a caller before, well, bake your cookies, try to make crackers without that terrible fat, I meant it. Because everybody gains, and you as a producer of good and healthy food will be the most, will have the most to gain.
So is that, is, Is that helped by the fact that we seem to have more recipes and cookbooks that are designed to try to help you get the food on the table in a shorter period of time?
I think that a lot of us are really trying to encourage people to cook and to bring back the family meal, because it's not just about eating together. It's about talking together. You teach kids manners at a table. You teach them how to have a conversation. There's a lot of civilizing that goes on around the food. It's not just about the food. It's about the whole family experience. Mm.
So what's your favorite thing to cook? Do you have one or two things?
It depends on when you ask the question. You know, right now I'm obsessed with soup making.
Well, it's the right time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. You know, and if you'd asked me the question in July, I'd be talking about fruit. But winter soups with beans and noodles and full of vegetables are things that I feel very good about cooking and serving.
Well, that sounds pretty good to me. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For people who are interested in reading it, I would recommend the book From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals by our guest Barbara Haber. It is available now in a paperback edition published by Penguin, out now. Well, there, we will have to wrap it up here. We do want you to know that our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. On Tuesday, November 16th, Corkscrew will host a five-course wine dinner in the Tuscan Room at Timponi's Restaurant, featuring the foods and wines of Italy's Piedmont region. Tickets available at the Corkscrew. Information at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. Tomorrow morning, again, a reminder that in the first part of the show, we'll be talking with Max Frankel, longtime reporter for the New York Times, has written a book looking back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. The book is titled High Noon in the Cold War. Then in hour number two, we'll be talking with Amita Bhaviskar. She's a sociologist from University of Delhi in India, talking about battles all over the world, battles about water. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope you stay tuned. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. John Kerry has made his concession call to President Bush, and he'll speak to supporters shortly. We'll join National Public Radio at the top of the hour for coverage of that speech to supporters. Sources say John Kerry called the president to offer his congratulations, and a Democratic official says Kerry told the president they must work to heal the nation's divisions. Again, we'll join National Public Radio at the top of the hour for John Kerry's speech to his supporters. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange now. December wheat trading at $2.99 3/4, down 2.5. March, $3.12, down 3. December corn, $1.99 1/4, down 1/2. March, $2.10 1/2, down 3/4. May, $2.18 1/4, down 1/2. December, $2.41 1/4, down 1/4. November beans, $5.25 1/2, down 2.5. January, $5.20. Down 5.5. March, $5.24, down 5. December meal, $1.50.50, down 60. December oil, $20.78, that down 21. November feeder cattle, $108.02 1/2, down 12.5. December live cattle, $84.00 even, down 25. December lean hog, $71.85, that down $2. February bellies, $99.40, up $1.40. December crude oil, $49.25, down 37. The CRB, $281.23, up 17. The U.S. dollar, $84.87, down 37. The Dow is up 126 points at 10,162. It's 1 minute before noon. You're tuned to AM 580 WIL.